your finances on a higher power. Being good stewards of the financial resources God has bestowed upon each of us is the key to financial success in life. It's your finances on a higher power. Here's your host, Paula T. Webb.
Welcome back, traders. This is Paula T. Webb coming to you from 1610 WBGS. It's a great place to be. This is the second day of February. And before we get started, I feel that I should mention that not only myself, but my family and my fellow ministers and friends are all sending our prayers and thoughts out to the families involved in the recent airline tragedies in Washington, D.C. and in Philadelphia. It's just really, really sad that the beginning of the year started out so badly, and hopefully the agencies involved will find out what the causes were so that it never happens again. So just maybe keep them in your prayers too as we move through this process of, you know, fixing whatever needs to be fixed. Okay? Thank you. Okay, so thank you to all of you guys that wrote in with some questions. I really appreciate that. And a lot of your questions the past couple weeks actually have been about money management. So I'm going to give you some examples. And I know I have given you these examples previously. And some of the examples are also on my social media and podcasts that I've done with other providers. But I think we kind of need to really hone this in as to how you need to stay connected to your money. I'm going to give you a couple examples here. on occasion, I have allergies. Okay, so my ears, you know, they just kind of get faint. You know, my hearing gets diminished, and it's due to the area I live in. If I go up to any altitude, my ears pop right open. So it's definitely a regional thing. So I don't necessarily need hearing aids, but when allergy season pops up, I just went on Amazon and got the little cheap hearing aids for $60, you know, just the little things you stick in your ear with batteries, right? And it works perfectly. And then when allergies are gone, I don't have to use them. So in the meantime, I bought some batteries at a store. I don't want to mention the store. But anyway, so I bought whole, like three or four packages of size 10 hearing aid batteries. Came home, went to go on duty with the sheriff's department as a chaplain, go to put the batteries in, nothing. They're dead. Now, the batteries themselves said they were good until 2028. I tried every single battery in all four packages, and they were all dead, just dead. So anyway, I took them back to the store, and they said, well, it's not our problem. You know, it's the expiration is good, so you're going to have to go to the manufacturer. Great. So I went online, contacted the manufacturer. Of course, they said, you have to go back to the store. Went back and forth. Now, okay, the amount of money that I was out was maybe about $30-some. That wasn't the issue. The issue was is that what I subsequently found out was that the manufacturer knew that that whole batch, that production batch, was defective. Of course, it took me a couple months to find this out, but eventually I did. So they were still selling these batteries and then making it extremely difficult for the consumer to get a refund or even just a replacement. And that's really all I wanted, was just batteries that worked. And they weren't even willing to do that, the manufacturer. And of course, the store did have its policy, since the expiration date was still 3 years out. There's no reason that they should have to refund my money or replace the product because it was a manufacturing issue. Okay, long story short, I kept hammering this manufacturing company, and I said, you guys owe me. Now I want the cash. I said, you just, you know, send me a check, whatever. I gave them the amount that I paid, including my local sales tax, and gave them the total. So this took about 6 months. Not every single day, guys, but the point is, it's my money. Okay, it's 30-some dollars, and I work hard for that. So eventually they got back to me and they said, okay, we will refund you the cost of those four packages, but we're not going to pay you the tax. So I had to get up in arms again and I said, yes, you are, because I paid the tax. They came back and said, well, the tax goes to your state or your city. I said, I don't care. You are going to make me 100% whole. And I asked them, I said, don't you ever watch Judge Judy? And I'm laughing because I just thought the whole thing was so absurd. Now, to those of you listening, you're probably saying, well, you're absurd for fighting for 6 months to get 30-some dollars back. But there's a point to these stories, okay? So just bear with me. So I went on and on, and I fought them for it. And a couple weeks later, they finally gave in. And not only did I get all my money back, but they also gave me $20 and a gift card. So, okay, yes, the 6 months that it took to get all this, did that warrant 50-some dollars? Yeah, it did. And you want to know why? Because I let them know they were not going to defraud me. And that's what they intended to do. This is a concentrated effort, at least on the part of this company, to make it so difficult for the consumer to get a refund or a replacement that most people will give up. So the point being here, guys, is that I'm connected to my money. I spent the money in good faith for a product. That product was defective. They knew it was defective, but they still did not want to honor giving me 100% refund. That's not happening in my life. That's just the way it is. And another situation is I bought a, it was a limited edition book, and it was coming out last July. I paid for it in advance, you know, a pre-order in March of 2024, never received anything. September of 2024 rolls around. I sent countless emails and left countless voice messages to this publishing company. No response. So I went back to my credit card issuer. And I said, hey, I never got the book. They're not responding. Filled out all the forms. I said, I'd like my $75 back. So they issued me a conditional credit. And then a month later, they recharged my card. So then I had to go into an argument with the credit card company, which is a, you know, worldwide company, and battle with them to get my money. I sent them the proof that from the U.S. Postal Service that the book had been sent to a wrong address and was returned to the publisher. So they had an unopened brand new book that they had back in their possession, and yet they told the credit card company the book was delivered. So here's another example of big business, shall we say, trying to take advantage of the consumer. I finally, you know, I'll be honest with you guys, I ended up pretty much screaming at my credit card company and told them that this was fraud on their part. They knew I had not received the book. They had all the proof. And yet they recharged my card because I'm just a person. I'm not this big publisher. Well, it doesn't matter to me if I'm just a person. What matters to me is I work for my money. I get up, I trade, I do consulting, I do this show, I work my butt off 7 days a week. So every single penny that I make is allotted for whatever I'm going to use it for. I'm connected to every penny I make. And I'm bringing this up because this is the way traders have to think. Every time you say, oh, well, you know, it's just $30, let it go. I don't feel like you know, the, you know, going through the hassle to get the refund. Okay. So what you're telling your mental environment, what you're telling your brain is 30 some dollars is not enough for you to make an effort to recoup. Well, that's ridiculous. It's your money. So what if it takes a little bit of effort? You have to have some pride in yourself. You have to connect to your money. So in other words, if you wouldn't go after that 30 some dollars or that $75 like I did, then what you're telling yourself is, I have no desire to go after any profit that isn't worth my time. Now, we all know when we put on trades, there's a probable amount of income, probable amount of profit that we may be able to take at any given moment while we're in that trade. Correct? Correct. So what we have to do, what we have to determine as traders is how much profit is enough. First of all, that's what everybody talks about. But more importantly, and I know I've brought this up before, guys, but I'm hammering this in tonight. How much profit is too little for you to take? Now think about this, guys, and I know you send me emails and you say, well, why should I waste my time for $20 in profit or $50 or $100 or $1,000, whatever is your number is and whatever market you're trading. I don't know. How much, you know, what's wrong with profit of $20 and then waiting for the next setup or getting right back in? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with $100? What's wrong with $1,000? I don't know about you, but to me, profit is profit. I don't qualify it. If I see profit, I'm going to take it. Period. Because I know and I believe there's always opportunity to make more in the market based on my analysis, my methodology, my criteria, my edge, and my knowledge. So money management as a trader, I'm only specifically talking about money management as a trader, boils down to believing in yourself. If you don't believe in your ability to take profit at any moment, then you can't manage your equity. That's the way it works, guys. We'll be right back. Okay, now again, I'm going to continue on this money management theme here for a little bit longer because I guess I don't really make it that clear for some of you, and I want to make sure that you really are understanding the thought process behind fighting for your money, okay? I mean, each one of us, when we enter the markets, we're heading into battle, aren't we? Of course we are, because we don't know what's going to happen, correct? Yes, guys, we don't know what's going to happen, okay? Just keep that in mind. So we have to adapt our brains to understand that anything can happen. And these days, we also have to expand that thought process or set of thought processes that we use as a trader sometimes in other areas. And that may involve credit cards or credit card companies or any other organization. Now I'm gonna give you a good example of this. And this is an example of intimidation financially. A number of years ago, Mark was in the Middle East. He was in either Dubai or he's in the Emirates. Either way, it's close enough. And he was giving a 3-hour presentation. And one of the attendees was a Saudi prince, a young guy. He was in his 20s. And he was so impressed by Mark's presentation that he wanted to buy a copy of one of our workshops. Now, you know, this was when internet piracy was starting, and so we weren't really selling the workshops outside the U.S. Now, I was at home. I didn't go on that trip because my mother at the time was very ill. So Mark called me from all the way across the world, and he said, okay, you know, we got this Saudi prince, and he wants a copy of the workshop. Now, for me, that was a red flag because I'm thinking, why would a Saudi prince need a copy of our workshop that he's already worth like gazillions of dollars? Well, I guess his family wanted him to start trading. So they wanted him to be, you know, they wanted his mindset to be right and all this kind of stuff. So I gave in and I said, fine, he's going to have to go on the website, fill out the request form, you know, fill out all the paperwork, send us an email. This is who he is. This is his address, copy of his ID, you know, because I'm not going to ship something halfway around the world and have it go to just some goofball, you know, in some chat room, right? So he followed all our procedure, sent his American Express card number, and then he wanted it sent overnight as quickly as it could be, which was like another $800. And it was actually going to a palace over there. So I thought, okay, well, the guy's legit. So all in all, it cost him initially on his American Express card, $7,500. Now, that may not seem like a lot of money to you guys, but $7,500 to me is a lot of money. Okay? You know, it just is. Okay? And so it was pretty exciting. So I raced to get, you know, the copy made and the manuals and all that kind of stuff. Shipped it out and required a signature, required ID to be shown that it was him signing for it, and all of the above. So I get an email from the guy thanking me, acknowledging that he received it and it was in good shape, customs didn't rip it apart or anything like that. So we're good. About 3 weeks later, we get a chargeback from American Express. Now, for those of you who don't know what chargebacks are, it's when somebody denies a charge. So I called up American Express and I said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, this guy said he never ordered this. And I said, well, he most certainly did, and I have all the paperwork. So according to them, I sent them everything that they needed, everything that they asked to prove that the order was legit and that he had ordered it. Went back and forth for a couple months, and he kept denying it. And American Express took the money out of our account. So push comes to shove. Now I'm really ticked off. Mark's like, let it go. And I'm like, no, this is $7,500. So I went all the way up the chain of command at American Express, and what it got right down to was he was a Saudi prince, and they weren't about to jeopardize their relationship with him over a measly $7,500. And I said, okay, but you're willing to jeopardize our relationship, you know, just two little people here in the U.S. And they said, yeah. I said, okay, well, thank you for letting us know, because we will never use your services again. And so what we did was we cut up our American Express cards. We canceled being able to take American Express for payment for our services or products. And a couple months later, we get, and in the meantime, I cut up the cards and I sent a letter to the CEO of American Express, included all the documentation, and told them I thought they were pretty bad people, just awful people. So a couple months later, get a letter from some executive at AMX, and he apologized profusely, and he said it was a mistake and all this kind of stuff. And they really wanted us to have an account with them again. And I said, no. And they said, look, you know, we'll give you 2% on your merchant, you know, your merchant account. I said, I will never work with you again. The fact that two people were meaningless compared to, you know, a mega wealthy Saudi prince, which I get the concept of, guys. Okay. I'm not that brainless, I said, but the fact is, it's people like us that helped American Express get started to begin with. And when you forget about people like us, then I don't want to have anything to do with you. That's my philosophy, guys. And it isn't about the money. What it's about is that I did everything they told me I needed to do, and they still denied the charge. They still took my money, and I lost. I wouldn't work with anybody like that. Now, you may say, well, you know, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. No, I'm not, because you know why? This all goes back to how you look at your trading. No matter how small or large the refund that you are owed, absolutely owed, if you ignore it or let it go, then the person or the company on the other side wins at fraud. Okay? Now, you may say, well, you know, you can't fight these big business. Yeah, you can. And you should. Because if you don't stand up for all of the money that you make, your hard-earned money as a trader, then you're not going to pay attention when you're trading for all those small profit-taking opportunities. This type of mentality trickles down to your trading. And what it's going to say is, well, I'm not going to make the effort or take the time to go after a small refund. And what that's going to tell your brain is, well, $50 or $100 or $1,000 isn't enough effort for me to take profit right now because I'm going to wait for the bigger number. It's the same energy, guys. When you dismiss being cheated, you will dismiss cheating yourself as a trader. It's the same thought processes. Now, you may say, I think you're taking this a little bit too far, which some of you do. You have to take it this far. It's your money. It's your money, guys. Why wouldn't you stand up for your money? You have an opportunity, probably at any given moment in the markets, to take profit. So why wouldn't you? No matter how small or how large, why wouldn't you take every single profit in front of you? You have to ask yourself that. And that's what I'm saying. If you're not willing to go after getting a refund that you are absolutely legitimately owed, then you're going to short yourself in the markets by not taking small profits. It's the same thought processes. And you guys, you really got to get this through your brain, okay? Now, if you really need to talk about this, you know, sign up for the introductory call, and we can go over it more specifically for your situation, okay? This is really key to you understanding money management. This is your money. You have to be connected to it 100% in every area of your life, but especially as you're trading. No profit is too small to take. No profit is too small to take because small profits add up to rising equity. Got that? Small profits add up to a rising equity curve. And that's what we're doing, guys. This is what you need to do. Think of it as, I'm growing my equity. We'll be right back.
Paula T. Webb will be back with us in a moment. It's Your Finances on A Higher Power.
Okay, guys. All right, so we're back. So I hope you guys understand what I'm trying to convey to you. And I know it doesn't seem like we have to have money management as traders, because one of the reasons, or one of the primary reasons, I should say, that we all got into trading was, you know, have no rules, have no boss, you know, be our own boss, you know, have freedom of thought. But, you know, the whole point of getting into trading and being a trader, being a successful trader, being a warrior trader, is to make money. And any endeavor you get into to make money, you have to have money management. You have to have a business plan. You have to have goals. Now, they may not, they're different because now they're your goals. They're not someone else's. But you still have to have goals. You still have to manage your account. Now, being a boom and buster isn't managing your account, is it? Managing your account would mean when you're in the boom cycle, you take at least 25 or 50% of your profit out of your trading account, put it aside where you can't wire it back in, because you still have 50% of that profit in your trading account, so you're still growing your trading account. That is money management. That is owning your profit. However, if you leave all the profit in, then you turn into a buster because you get sloppy. Because you're like, oh yeah, well I got all this extra money I can play with. When you're not even in the frame of mind to manage what you have to begin with. So, you know, our second book, Trading in the Zone, is an all-time bestseller on Amazon. Because we teach you to the best of our ability in that book, although it's not the complete picture, like I keep reminding you guys, that you have to be in a zone. You have to be in your warrior zone. You have to be in your trading zone. You have to be in your money management zone. And a lot of the reasons that traders can't get in, or rather stay in, any one of those zones is there's a lot of trading myths out there. And there's a lot of trading myths that are perpetuated on the internet. I can't tell you how crazy this drives me, guys, because it's a bunch of hooey. There's a lot of stuff out there that these people that just throw up a website that looks real slick and they claim this or that, and it really has nothing to do with trading at all. So last week I said we were going to go over some common trading myths, so we ran out of time. So I'm going to give you some of these trading myths, the most common ones, here today. So the first one we'll talk about is, I need to be in multiple markets to have a feel for market action. Now, I know a lot of you guys claim this when you call me for coaching or you come to my workshop. That is not true. That is completely false. I know a lot of successful traders who only trade in one or two markets. That's it. And they have pulled millions out of the markets over the years. I mean, Robert St. John, who I talk about all the time, probably the all-time forever in the history of T-bonds, was the best T-bond trader I've ever seen in my life. And that's all he traded. When we got him down to just trading that one market, I mean, the sky was the limit for this guy. And I know I've told you this before. He could trade from 9 to 11 in the morning, and he would be pulling out anywhere from $250 to $1.2 million every day. Every day, guys. And you know why? Because he knew that market. Now, you know, we have taught learn one market and learn it well forever. Since the beginning of our you know, collaboration, Mark Douglas and I. And I continue to teach that this day. Because the point is, if you don't learn one market inside and out, then you can't learn any other market inside and out. And if you don't know one market, then you can't add two or three or four or five into the mix, because then you don't know any of them except peripherally. You see what I'm getting at? So let's say, I mean, that would be like, say, okay, I'm going to learn how to drive a car, you know, with a standard transmission. And you do that for a couple of days, and you say, well, I'm going to try a four on the floor or a stick shift, manual transmission. Okay, well, maybe I'm not, I think I'm going to go learn how to drive a motorcycle. Okay, so that's three different types of driving, right? Three different mechanical mechanisms that your brain has to absorb. I don't know about you, but, you know, when I was learning how to drive, you know, I learned, you know, the standard transmission first. And I didn't get to drive my brother's stick shift until a year later. There was no way he was going to let me, you know, drive his stick shift Well, he had an MGB. It was an expensive car back then. Of course, that was probably part of it too. But the bottom line is he wanted to make sure I was a competent driver, that I knew how to drive a car inside and out. Then I could go to a stick shift. Now, to this day, I really love driving a stick shift. I think it's awesome. However, I never could wrap my brain around driving a motorcycle. Now, I'm used to, you know, the clutch on the floor, you know, the gas, the pedal on the floor, the stick shift on my right hand. I could not wrap my brain around the hand gears and the foot gears for a motorcycle. Now, probably a lot of you guys are out there laughing at me, but, you know, it's just what it is. You know, it's okay. I'll just be a passenger on a motorcycle. And I know I've mentioned this before. So I'm just making the analogy that I know how to drive a car. You all know how to drive a car inside and out, right? So then if you want to learn how to drive a boat, you're going to learn how to do that. That's pretty simple anyway. If you're going to learn how to drive a stick shift, you're going to learn how to do that, and a motorcycle and so forth. But you had to start somewhere. You had to start with a regular car before you could move on to something else. Okay? Do you understand what I'm saying? So don't feel whatever anybody else is telling you about, well, you got to be in all these markets, which I hear all the time and see on the internet. That is not true at all. You can be in one market and make tons of money because you're going to know that market inside and out. Okay, the second myth. I have to trade big to win big. Again, false. Now, you can have a steady approach to your trading without putting yourself at high risk for a huge hit, a big drawdown. And you can still pull out whatever you desire, whatever amount of profit you desire, you want, or you think you can get from the markets. You don't have to trade big initially. It's called consistency and steady. Now, if you can do that for a year, then you can increase your size after you have achieved the appropriate thought processes of consistency, steadily growing your equity, trusting yourself to do what needs to be done, and having confidence. But if you're going to continue to be a boom and buster, then how is it you think you're ever going to be able to increase your contract size if you keep blowing up your account? You're never going to trust yourself. Okay, the next thing is, and this is one that a lot of the moderators on TV say, trading psychology is not necessary, only analysis is. Now, if you believe that, then you will spend 99% of your time researching and doing analysis. And you'll be doing that for the rest of your trading years without ever having succeeded at reaching your financial goals. And I have a lot of traders that call me, guys, and they are stuck in analysis. They are paralyzed with analysis. And they're too afraid to step out of that closed loop to put on anything, you know, but very, very, very small contract size. So if you have the proper warrior mindset, understand that you need to be a warrior in your thinking processes to take profit anytime it makes itself available to you, then you're going to create a rising equity curve. Okay, another one is RSI is better than candlesticks. Candlesticks is better than P&L. P&L is better than S&R and so forth. That's wrong. Now, these people that are suggesting that, they may be teaching RSI. They may be teaching candlesticks. They may be teaching P&L. That's great because each one of those methodologies and more, I mean, there's countless methodologies, but I'm just giving you a few as example. Each one of those is good. They all work. It's just how you use them. But the difference is you have to choose what methodology is right for you because all methodologies have good points. So, you know, pick one methodology and learn it well. Give it a year. See how well it works with your market. I need at least 3 or 4 monitors to be able to watch market action. False. Okay, here we go again, guys. If you have to have a certain number of monitors to view the markets, you are in information overload. That's it. You don't need more than 2 monitors to start trading, to trade with initially. And again, guys, this is initially. You don't need more than that to start the first year you're trading. Once you become confident with your methodology, your edge, not moving your stops, you have some self-confidence. If you want to add more markets, that's fine. But don't do it for at least the first year of your trading. You know, Mark and I used to say the first 2 years, but I'm going to back off a little bit here, guys, just because, you know, the ease of information has you know, gotten much more simpler over the years. So just keep that in mind, that you do not need countless numbers of equipment. All right. I had a guy in California. He had 7 monitors, 3 computers, and 2 backup computers. And he couldn't put on a trade for the life of him. But he said that he needed more. He had to get 2 more computers as backups. It was ridiculous. I told him to go down to 3 monitors and 2 computers, and he didn't need 3 computers as backups. You know, just have a, you know, external hard drive. And he couldn't do it. And he blew up his entire account within 9 months. Okay, well, I'm going to give you guys a break and we'll be right back. Okay, now I could go on with more myths, but we'll save some for another show. What I want to get into in this part of the show is faith. And, you know, don't start rolling your eyes and don't start groaning, because, you know, some of you have written in and said, hey, you know, I'm not Catholic, or I'm not Lutheran, or I'm not Christian, or whatever. So I want to clarify the fact that I'm not saying that you need to be Christian to be listening to what I'm saying. You don't need to be Christian to be a trader. You don't need to be anything except true to yourself. Okay? Now, just because I mention, you know, quotes from, you know, the Holy Bible, I could sit here and quote things from Mahatma Gandhi, which I think I did some time ago. I could quote from Hindu scriptures. I could quote from just about any other scripture, because I have a PhD in philosophy, and part of that degree included learning about the world religions. My father was a lifelong seeker. Now, when he and my mother got married in the 40s, they decided, you know, we were Irish, and they decided that they would raise us kids Catholic until we turned to the age of 15, because then we had gone through the 3 steps of becoming an adult in the Catholic faith, baptism, First Communion, and confirmation. And my father said, when you hit 15, you're on your own. You can do what you want. Now, my father absolutely believed in God. He didn't necessarily subscribe to going to a special building to pray to him or talk to him. And I would see my father lots of times sitting on the back porch by himself, having a cigarette with his eyes closed. And as my mother told me when I was young, he's talking to God, leave him alone. So I learned at an early age that you can talk to God anywhere. And I've mentioned this before, guys. Now, in my office, I have a piece of Waterford that's shaped in the number 1. Okay? That's reminding me that I am number 1 to myself. I have a beautiful painting of Lakshmi, who is the Hindu god of prosperity. And that reminds me that God provides prosperity. I have a Bible page which has the 10 Commandments in Hebrew. And I have a couple movie posters which are important to me. One of them is from the movie Training Day with Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke. That is, if you guys have seen it, it's a pretty rough movie about, crime and cops and good cops versus bad cops and good guys versus bad guys. And it's a very, very telling movie because the Ethan Hawke's character has to learn that his idealistic view of what he thought law enforcement was about wasn't necessarily true. And in the end, it was okay because he stayed true to himself. Meaning he had a connection, and I'm extrapolating here, of course. Let's just say I assume Ethan Hawke's character had a connection to God because he stayed true to himself no matter what was thrown in front of him, no matter what was thrown at him, and he stood true to his values. That's huge, especially in today's world. Another one of the posters I have on my wall is The Godfather, which we've talked about earlier. The Godfather, to me, represents ultimate power. I'm not promoting anything criminal here. I'm just saying that the mindset of having ultimate power to achieve your goals comes from God. Now, I'm not saying anybody in the Godfather movie or any of the characters in either movie, you know, it was God telling them to be bad people. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is when you are connected to your inner self, when you have a relationship with God, then your path remains clear as to what you want to accomplish. Another poster I have in here is from the original movie Spartacus, starring Kirk Douglas. That's one of my all-time favorite movies. You have a guy born into slavery, and ultimately, deep down inside, when he becomes free, there comes a point where he has a defining moment, and he says, I'm not going to take it anymore, because he knows there's a higher calling for him. And he knows that, even though it doesn't say that in the movie, he knows that because he wouldn't have been able to do what he did if he didn't believe that. And of course, the other one is Ben-Hur with Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston was a rich landowner, I guess, or a merchant in, you know, ancient Rome. He even had slaves. You know, he gets in trouble. He becomes a slave himself. He comes back. He's angry. And then, you know, through the grace of God, the anger fades and he finds his true nature again. So the bottom line is, guys, it doesn't matter what it takes for you to get on your path to prosperity as a trader. It doesn't matter what it takes to make you think like a warrior, which all of these men in all these movies are warriors. You can be a warrior just for yourself, like me. I'm a warrior for me. I'm a warrior because I know God is with me. And God is going to support me as I pursue my goals. That's the beauty of having faith. So it doesn't matter where your faith comes from. It doesn't matter what you subscribe to, or if you never go to church, it doesn't matter as long as you believe in God. Because he's there for you. He knows what's in your heart. He knows what's in your mind. He knows what you want to accomplish. And he's there to help you achieve that. No matter what's going on around you, no matter what's going on in the world. So if you always look to him, you're going to be safe. You're going to be prosperous. You're going to be happy. You're going to be healthy. I know this because I live it, and I have lived it, and I've been through heck and back again. I've been through a lot of stuff, and I'm back and better than before because I trusted in him. Okay? So please, guys, if you're not really into that, give it a shot. Or if you want more information on that, let me know. Okay? I'm happy to talk philosophy about this with you. I'm happy to talk about what it means to have faith. And I'm certainly happy to talk to you about my new book coming out, The Sacred Path of the Warrior Trader, because that's what it's all about, is believing in yourself and believing that God believes in you too. listening to him and hearing him and following through. So this is Paula T. Webb of paulatweb.com, the best of the best in trading psychology in the new age of becoming a warrior trader, embracing the spirit. And we will be back next week with some more awesome news for you, the good news. And again, thanks again to 1610 WBGS. It's a great place to be. And you all have a wonderful trading week.
Paula T. Webb, co-author of The Disciplined Trader, The Complete Trader, and several other all-time best-selling, award-winning books, including Trading in the Zone, books that set the bar on trading psychology. You can find her classic books on Amazon and on her website, www.paulatweb.com.